Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And we're looking, as we often do, at Sheila Fitzpatrick's Everyday Stalinism this evening. And there's a particularly interesting chapter in the book which talks about how ordinary Soviet citizens were able to write to government ministers, to Stalin himself and to other organs of the state, and how their letters were catalogued, and how often their grievances were recorded. This is an aspect of totalitarian society that often gets overlooked, with really popular engagement with totalitarianism. In Christopher Duggan's brilliant book, Fascist Voices, the fascist voters and supporters of Mussolini would frequently write to the Duce and write to him with kind of requests, sometimes trivial, sometimes important, their hopes and fears, their points of view, their ideas. And it tells us, firstly, that these letters were, if not welcomed, then accepted, and that people very often knew quite clearly what their relationship with a totalitarian state was. In the case of the Stalinist state, being able to talk back to power actually helps to comprise part of what we call the surveillance society. So, Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "As we've seen, Soviet surveillance of the popular mood had its consultative aspect in the forms of public discussions, election meetings, and authorities' willingness to accept individual complaints and petitions. But all these public consultative forums were constrained to varying degrees unsatisfactory to both sides, the watchers and the watched. Knowing that the regime might punish somebody who said the wrong thing in public, citizens preferred to discuss public affairs outside these forums and in different ways from the official prescribed one. Suspecting that citizens were unlikely to say what they really thought in public, the authorities, in particular the NKVD, sought to extend their surveillance to citizens' off-the-record discussions, those that were outside the range of state surveillance. This meant that attempting to monitor not only conversations in private homes and private correspondence, but also anonymous and subversive public communications like jokes, songs, rumours, verbal outbursts against the regime and abusive letters to the authorities." Much as with the Nazi state, public opinion was of paramount importance to the Stalinist state. it's assumed wrongly that dictators of the 20th century have cared little for public opinion, knowing that they are able to crush signs of dissent and use terror and armed force. Well, terror and armed force are used when necessary, when all other methods expire, when all other methods are deemed to be useless. But by and large, dictators such as Hitler and Stalin had were highly conscious of public opinion and viewed that they ruled with a high degree of public consent, which to some extent that can be said to be true. Anonymous public exchanges that occurred in places, in public places, like queues or in railroad compartments, in markets or in the kitchens of communal apartments, were the hardest kind of verbal sort of exchange of ideas, information, beliefs and that sort of thing for historians to really sink their teeth into. Soviet ethnographers would collect chastushki, which were songs on topical subjects, which were often set to well-known melodies, and that people would kind of improvise and add to and add verses to and new words to and that kind of thing. But during the 1930s, it obviously made it impossible to publish any of that kind of material. So we have to rely mainly on the ethnography of the NKVD, which was the information and inferences collected by secret policemen listening in queues in public places to what was being said. How useful that is as a source is questionable, because these were the only thing that you could record really was the information that a stranger would hear. The kinds of things that might be said more intimately are perhaps beyond our ability to know. So yes, these sorts of information came from listening to queues in markets, writing down jokes and rumours, and Russian popular memory, which is good for jokes, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, even at half a century's remove, but less good for other forms of anonymous public communication. So it should be remembered that the NKVD ethnographers, when they were trying to hear, you know, a particularly good subversive joke or rumour, they would also have the role of arresting the person who told the joke. So that made people extremely wary. One of the paradoxes of a repressive society like the Soviet Union is that the information, and this goes the same for Nazi Germany, the information that the regime desperately wanted to hear and wanted to know, views and attitudes, was very, very carefully guarded, with people knowing precisely what might happen to them if they weren't careful. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "Rumours disseminate information, or alleged information, on public matters to those who hunger for it, but they also express popular hopes and fears, an attempt to explain puzzling events. Thus, Soviet rumours in the 1930s constantly dwelt on the imminence of war, which was feared by many and hoped for by some. They brought news of popularly desirable policy changes like amnesties and religious toleration. They spoke threateningly of the Bartholomew's Day massacres that were imminent if food shortages continued. They offered various explanations to Kirov's murder, including an ingenious one that implied a causal link based on chronological conjecture between the murder and the indignation of working folk at the abolition of rationing." So much as with our own time, where rumour, conjecture, fantasy and conspiracy theory are bundled up and disseminated across social media and greatly kind of accelerated by the power of social media. Societies like the Soviet Union, which were secretive and were conspiratorial societies, had their own kind of subculture of rumour and conjecture and conspiracy theory. And again, conspiracy theories that exist in societies that are highly conspiratorial doesn't necessarily make the conspiracy theory correct, but it goes some way to explaining why people who are starved of open information and accurate and transparent information find narratives like conspiracy theories able to slot in the middle. It's interesting that Sheila Fitzpatrick discusses the rumours of war in Stephen Kotkin's first volume, The Paradoxes of Power, the first volume of his biography of Stalin. Most of the period of time from 1924 to 1928, when the study ends, moving on to its sequel, Stalin is obsessed by the possibility of invasion. Partly this is to do with the kind of the ideological worldview of the revolution, that bourgeois nations will ultimately try to overthrow the revolution as a kind of a historical inevitability. This is, you know, a Marxist and Leninist prediction. And Stalin perceives world events from Great Britain to China as having greater significance than perhaps they did. And the threat of future invasion makes for a kind of a febrile and tormented and suspicious and paranoid political culture within the Soviet Union, which preempts itself towards state repression and eventually terror. Stalin essentially looks overseas and says, right, we have a decade maybe to get ready for the great capitalist onslaught. We are going to have to get rid of the enemies within. And because they are the first ones, the most dangerous ones, who will help the enemy when eventually that occurs. So one diarist of the 1930s argued that a majority of the jokes that one could hear in the Soviet Union were about politics, unsurprisingly. The famous Harvard Project, where it was possible for one time only for really American researchers to get their hands on some really deep social research into the Soviet Union, had a one of the respondents arguing or stating that they highly valued the rumours that they heard. They saw rumours as being very useful bits of information. And that tells us, perhaps in this instance, perhaps in others, that people were listening for rumours, for announcements, for major political events. This individual remembered rumours about new laws, imminent arrests, some big man would be imprisoned, and it would not be in the newspapers, but people knew it. Price rises and food shortages. They would say that soon there would not be any sugar or bread, and this is how usually it happened. The rumours were justified. But others, other of the respondents were less confident on the reliability of rumours. One reported rumours of the early 1940s that collective farms would be abolished after the war, and bells rung in churches, suggesting the NKVD agents themselves pass these rumours out because they knew people liked to hear them. Another recalled that there were many false rumours, especially during the Great Purges. For example, we heard two or three times that supposedly Molotov had disappeared.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So there's lots of fascinating stuff here. You could think of rumours as being a rather chaotic channel of discourse, a means by which people acquire information, not all of it particularly accurate. It might be that there were certain Soviet citizens who looked on rumours as being more reliable than the Soviet press itself, or some Soviet citizens who consumed rumours as a way of their own kind of social connection and their ability to relate to one another's. Often, Soviet citizens would tire of the repetitive nature of Soviet propaganda terminologies such as life has become better, comrades, or catch up and overtake the West, these slogans that were often heard within in the Soviet press. And they would sometimes take these and turn them into jokes. A frequent one was to catch up and overtake the West, was the witticism, when we catch up the capitalist countries, can we stay there, for example. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, acronyms and initials, another favourite of Soviet officialdom, were the occasion for many jokes, usually during variant readings. The initials of the Communist Party in the 1930s, VKP, were read by peasant wits to stand for Second Serfdom, Vittorio Kropotnio Pravo, which while in the reading of some Leningrad youths, the initials of the USSR itself, SSSR or CCCP, in Russian became Stalin's death will save Russia, Smert Stalina spasit Rossiya. There was also a hidden and subversive typesetting that happened in Russian magazines and newspapers. Sometimes it was honest errors, sometimes it was practical jokes, other times it was political statements. Despite there being harsh punishment for such actions, the censors had to look out for small changes in the text of newspapers, brochures and books that could have been typographical errors but played havoc with the sense of meaning. Liquidation of illiteracy, which was a favourite slogan, somehow became liquidation of food in one provisional newspaper. In another paper, portraits of Politburo members appeared in unfortunate proximity to a story on economic statistics entitled Heads of Cattle in the USSR. There were some place names honouring leaders like Kirovgrad and Stalingrad were transmuted into Kirovgad and Stalingrad, Grad, for example, means city. Gad means scoundrel or crook. One area for ridicule and verbal abuse were the Stakhanovites, the generation of model workers in the USSR, who had been recognised by the state for their epic and gargantuan feats in the workplace, breaking quotas and work norms and that kind of thing. They were often viewed as the kind of the teacher's pets of the regime, and were the butt of many jokes. One saying, "What are they giving out?" asked a deaf lady joining a queue. "A slap in the face," someone replies. "To everyone or just the Stakhanovites?" You know, I suppose you have to be there, really. But that gives you a flavour of kind of how the Stakhanovites were viewed. In some circles, they were revered as heroes of labour. But very often, this kind of rather crass propagandising by the authorities meant that there would be resentments, and that people who were so closely associated with trying to set an example in a workplace that is largely oppressive and unattractive were only ever going to really generate a degree of respect and a degree of ridicule. Another joke concerns awarding the prizes to Stakhanovite milkmaids. In a formal ceremony, the milkmaid gets a radio receiver, the second a gramophone, and the third a bicycle. And then comes the fourth, the leading pig tender of the kolkhoz, the collective farm, to whom, with much emotion, the kolkhoz director presents the complete works of our beloved comrade Stalin. There is awed silence, and a voice is heard from the back, "Just what the bitch deserves." And there were also jokes about the terror. One joke reads, "In 1937, at night, there is a knock on the door. A husband goes to answer. He returns and says, 'Don't worry, dear, it's bandits who've come to rob us.'" Or in another joke, one person asks to another in prison, "What are you in for?" "For being talkative." "I told some jokes. And you?" "For laziness. I heard a joke and thought, I'll tell them tomorrow, but a comrade didn't waste time." One thing that appears to be abundantly clear, that despite state repression and censorship and surveillance and terror, there was nothing that the authorities could do in order to prevent outpourings of individual or collective public anger. Poor housing, food shortages, the possibility of war in the future, and the general disgust and dislike at a state which was seen as taking care of a small bureaucratic elite, riven with corruption and managerialism. There was inevitably going to be public outpourings of anger, and Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, One real life outburst was reported from a village meeting on the perennial favourite topic of Soviet propagandists, the international situation and the danger of war. One member of the audience, who had heard all of this once too often, jumped up from his place and cried out, shaking with anger, "To hell with this kind of life. Let there be war. The sooner the better. I'll be the first to go." A similar outburst was triggered at a factory discussion on the new constitution by mention of Stalin's "Life Has Become Better" slogan. When discussion turned to the fact that life has become better, life has become more cheerful, one worker threw the brochure of the draft constitution on the floor and began to trample it with his feet, shouting, "To hell with your constitution. It has given me nothing. I am going hungry. My whole family is going hungry. I have begun to live the worse. It was better before. Anonymous letters to the authorities often contained abuse and invective against the regime, expressing the same pent-up anger,
because anonymity was a better cloak than drunkenness, which was often how the regime explained away people's kind of anger or abuse. Writing these letters was not risk-free. It was entirely possible the NKVD could trace the authors, and often did do. The writers were clearly aware of this, and so some anonymous letters contained challenges to the NKVD to identify their authors. Some anonymous letters contained outright threats as to when the Committee for the Salvation of the People, homemade organisation, warned Zhdanov that he and other leaders had better watch out or they would get this to go the same way as Kirov, or when an anonymous individual warned that if prices were not lowered, the rest of the leaders would share Kirov's fate. It's clear that kind of the issue of the murder of Kirov keeps coming up again and again in the popular Soviet psyche. And the assassination of Kirov had the same effect on the Soviet Union, and perhaps the assassination of Kennedy had in America during the 1960s. In commonplace in many of these letters were ethnic slurs, often anti-Semitic ones, and expressions of popular prejudices that ran deep in Russian society. And they often would state in these letters to Soviet leaders and to Soviet politicians that, for example, the Jews or Georgians or Armenians or other ethnic minorities, Poles, Germans, were now running the country. One anonymous letter to Pravda began, "We, unfortunate citizens of a Jewish Armenian country," and the letter went on to protest the closings of churches, blaming this on some sort of imagined anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. The Russian Revolution, much as sort of the Nazis had looked upon this sort of myth of Judeo-Bolshevism, there were people in Russia who believed it as well. They believed that the Russian Revolution had been run by the Jews, said one author, and the Jews were trying to take over the world. Who needs internationalism? Only Jews. Authors of anonymous letters, writes Judith Fitzpatrick, accused the regime of being dominated by Jews and its non-Jewish members like Stalin and Kirov of selling out to the Jews. Stalin's nationality did not escape attention. One anonymous letter mocked him as the Caucasian Prince Stalin. One writer expressed his anti-Semitic sentiments in verse, calling on the reader to remember that the USSR was a country without rights and without law, of innocent victims and brazen slaughterers, a country where the slave and the spy reign, and Jews triumph over the holiness of the idea. So there was a subversive, sometimes bigoted, sometimes resentful, sometimes playful and mischievous culture of jokes, of letters, of slogans. And these are the ways in which ordinary people navigate these extraordinary events, these extraordinary impositions upon their personal lives and ambitions and hopes and freedoms and fears and desires, and how ordinary people navigated this new revolutionary society and state which had largely been imposed upon them. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and I'll be back with you next week for another podcast. Do remember, if you can support us, to go to our Patreon page, Finding Explaining History on Patreon, as we do benefit from the generosity of our patrons. Come and check us out in the Explaining History Facebook group. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.